Ladies and gentlemen, step right up.
January 20th, 2017 will be remembered as the day the people became the rulers of this nation again. We assembled here today are issuing a new decree to be heard in every city, in every foreign capital, and in every hall of power. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. We do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine as an example. We will shine for everyone to follow. There should be no fear. We are protected, and we will always be protected. We will be protected by the great men and women of our military and law enforcement. And most importantly, we will be protected by God. We stand at the birth of a new millennium, ready to unlock the mysteries of space, to free the earth from the miseries of disease, and to harness the energies, industries, and technologies of tomorrow. A new national pride will stir our souls, lift our sights, and heal our divisions. Your voice, your hopes, and your dreams will define our American destiny. Together, we will make America strong again. We will make America wealthy again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
Let's go see our friends. When I'm a roll of honey.
This is Christopher Hart. Welcome to the American Adversaries Second Helping Podcast, where we give you a sample of the American Adversaries radio show, which you can listen to live Sunday through Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on our website, AmericanAdversaries.com, our Rumble channel, American Adversaries, and on our station's website, TheAnswerOrlando.com. Congressman Corey Mills joined Mike McBath, Randy Ross, and me again on Trumpin' Tuesday to discuss the deteriorating situation in Ukraine and the prospects of another COVID shutdown and more mandates. And it is time for DC Declassified with Congressman Corey Mills, brought to us on this Trumpin' Tuesday by Sutherland Nissan. Congressman Mills, once again, thanks for spending some time with us.
It's an honor to be back, and always love to join you guys on Trumpin' Tuesday.
All right, we appreciate it. We know you got some important things going on in your life right now, so we especially appreciate the time. Where should we start? Let's start with Maui. You know, Biden goes out there and mangles the whatever he was trying to do yesterday, but more importantly, this fire being blamed on climate change when clearly the, shall we say, the results of the fire are a result of liberal Democrat policies implemented over years and years. And I kind of like the way Steve Moore characterized it. He said, this is not the result of climate change. This is the result of climate change fanaticism. Just your comments about the situation in general.
Well, I mean, first off, obviously, you know, thoughts and prayers are out to everyone who lost someone or they lost their homes during a very difficult time in Maui. You know, it's unfortunate that yet again, we've got Joe Biden, who is not only tone deaf, but out of touch with the realities of real America. You know, this is the equivalent of when he was checking his watch as they were offloading now a two-year anniversary coming up of 13 Gold Star families and their loved ones who were killed overseas. And now he's falling asleep and or wanting to try and lament on his own issues as opposed to being empathetic to the needs that are there. You know, it's interesting, though, if you look at not just his actions, not just his lack of empathy or his inability to show a personality, but his financial measures as well. He wants to allocate another $20 billion to Ukraine, and meanwhile, he was talking about $700 per person in Maui, which equates to about $9.1, $9.3 million. You know, this is what I mean when I talk about this America last, China first type of ideology that this administration has continued to push. And it's interesting that, you know, they can continue to have a plethora of special counsels go out and launch multiple investigations. How about they go ahead and assign one to Maui, go ahead and look at the true investigation as to the reasoning behind the actual fire to begin with. So, you know, this entire thing to me is just, you know, more of what we're used to under the Biden administration, but it's not what America should be accustomed to.
Let me ask you more specifically about the funding, because I thought I'd seen some reports that said that Biden was going to seek additional funding for Maui, but that it was going to be try to tie it to the extra funding, that extra $40 billion supplemental spending that they wanted previous to the fires, which included $24 billion for Ukraine. And that if the Republican leadership went along with that, it would put people like you, who might be inclined to vote against the extra funding for Ukraine, in the position of, if you did that, you would be voting for additional relief for Maui. Did I get all of that wrong?
No, I mean, this is the typical D.C. dance and why the swamp is the swamp. They know that if they try to bring those bills independently of one another, that I would always vote to support America First agenda, and especially get the money that's needed to try and help out, whether it be with FEMA and Maui or the individuals direct. And yet he knows as well that people like me will not continue to vote for this open blank checkbook to send more money to Ukraine. So he's going to try and tether them together. Well, I hate to disappoint him on this, and this isn't because I don't love the people of Maui. This isn't because I don't prioritize the people of Maui. It's just simply that if they try to tether these bills together, I'm going to have to vote against it. And I'll vote against it because I don't believe in sinking tens of billions of dollars more into Ukraine, where there is no actual guaranteed strategy. There is no national security interest in any type of plight there. But furthermore, we just saw where Germany said that they would not even pay their 2% of GDP into NATO, bearing in mind that NATO was created in 1947 to stop Soviet expansionism. And those who would be most at risk, the countries like Italy, France, and Germany, who refuse to pay their 2%, why should Americans keep funding and bearing the burden financially for wars that are more impacting them than it is us? And so, you know, at this stage, I would not be surprised if they try to tether those two bills together, but I can tell you that I will not vote to support that bill. I will look to separate those. The same way that I will not vote for a clean CR until we actually start looking at things like border security and ensuring that we prioritize American industry. And so this comes down to a simple thing, Chris. D.C. has continued to try and make their metric of success based upon how much they spend and not being on outcome. And this has continued to increase our debt ceiling and showed the fiscal irresponsibility of the swamp. If we continue to do the same things over and over and over again, we are actually living in the, you know, definition of insanity. And what we really need is to bring some fiscal sanity back to America and back to the American people.
One follow-up on this. Wouldn't it require the House leadership, Kevin McCarthy, to go along with this plan to implement it?
Well, potentially it would deal with not just McCarthy, but all of the leadership, to include certain chair positions and appropriations, financial, et cetera. But I think that it's very clear from a large majority, myself and our colleagues, who have said that we will not go along with these types of tethering, the same way that we got rid of the omnibus and didn't want to have those in the minibus. We want 12 appropriation bills as we had designated and intended. So, you know, we can keep talking about the fact that we've elected in and we are the majority there in the House, but until we start acting like the majority, it's nothing but loose talk.
Congressman, you know, it's interesting. Let's go back to that $700 versus the billions that we're giving to Ukraine. What's it like when you're up there and you're seeing that? I mean, I'm not saying we need to give, you know, millions and millions of dollars to everybody that's infected, been impacted by the fires in Maui. I just think as an American populace, we're looking at this and trying to understand, How do you, as a congressman, how does the Congress look at this? How does the government look at this and say, this is okay for Maui, but this is better for Ukraine? How do you wrap your head around the solution when things like that are occurring?
Well, Randy, I don't try to wrap my head around how Congress has worked. We know that if Congress worked at all, that it wouldn't be as effective as it has been. And so I don't try to put myself into the mind of what other, you know, Congress members have thought in the previous administrations or previous cycles, 117th, 116th, 115th, who all voted for additional funding. What I do look at is, what is the most fiscally responsible? What is the constitutional pillars in which I can stand on? What puts the 7th District of Florida, the state of Florida, and our country first above all? Those are the metrics that I use as my pillars of sanity. And I think that, you know, having looked at the freshman class that's come in, gentlemen like Wesley Hunt, Morgan Luttrell, and Anna Paulina Luna, and some others, you see where there's a lot of freshmen who's come in who does understand the idea of fiscal sanity, who does understand that continuing status quo in Congress has not worked and has failed the American people. And so when I look at this, this isn't a matter of, you know, me throwing money towards any other nation. That's a no-brainer for me. We prioritize Americans first, and we know that the people of Maui need the support. They need FEMA. We need to get out there and make sure that we're doing everything we can to help with rescue and recovery efforts, make sure we're helping to rebuild. And that's the top priority right now. It's not sending tens of billions of dollars to Ukraine, which is the last thing we should be talking about. If we're going to send 10, if we have 20 to 30 to $40 billion more that can be sent to Ukraine, why can't we allocate that funding to go ahead and secure our borders? That right there in itself would have a drastic impact and improvement on American lives. When you talk about the hundreds of thousands who are dying from fentanyl overdose, or you think about the innocent of children that are being robbed away, as you look at the child and human sex trafficking rates that have increased from what was a $500 billion industry in 2018 to a $13 billion industry in 2021. I mean, I guarantee if you go to the cartel's Employee of the Month wall, it's got Joe Biden and Secretary Mayorkas on it every month. But the reality is that we have to get back to fiscal sanity, and the only way we're going to do that is to start explaining to leadership as well as everyone else that I will not sign up and I will not vote yes on another appropriations bill until we start dealing with American issues.
Speaking of Ukraine, there are many reports now that indicate, I think it has been put mildly, that the counteroffensive has not achieved its objectives. I think another way to put it is it has been an absolute disaster. Meanwhile, Ukrainian tourists continue to go to tourist locations throughout the Middle East, including, we found out last night, Israel. And we've seen videos of what you would think was from Miami South Beach, of women and guys frolicking on a beach somewhere in Ukraine, as this war continues to go on and we continue to pump money into it. You just mentioned Germany. Perhaps one reason why Germany won't pony up the 2% is their economy is in the toilet because of this war, and they're very angry about that. Are any of the committee chairmen putting together hearings to actually look into exactly what has been going on in Ukraine, exactly how we got into this mess, where the money has gone, and any notions of thinking about how to get out of this mess?
Well, Chris, I mean, if you go back the fourth day after I was elected in and I had gone up and done my orientation, I sat down and Marjorie Taylor Greene had put an HRS inquiry on the table that I signed up to, as well as for a couple of others, that was demanding a 100% accountability and audit on all funding, and there couldn't be any further allocation until that auditing had been completed. That has never come to the floor, even though that was something they had promised they would bring to the floor. So to answer your question, no, there's many members who have signed on to this HRS inquiry, who has demanded it, who has signed on to it, who has never allowed it to see the light of day onto the House floor. And so until that happens, I can tell you that that was the other reason that myself, Congressman Gates, and a few others voted against additional funding on the amendments that was coming through with the National Defense Authorization Act. And so there's a lot of things that need to occur in order for us to get our House in order. And the first one that we have to do is ensure that we have proper auditing accountability, because as representatives of the United States Congress, we are stewards of the taxpayers' money, and we cannot continue to play status quo and kick the can and outspend everyone else without really tangible outcomes. Again, this has been my biggest thing that I see in Congress, Chris. And Randy, I think I've said this to you in the past, but, you know, the metric of success in Congress and in the D.C. isn't the outcome that you get. It's how much did you spend. And that's why you hear so many legislators start out every single time and their press releases go, we've spent more in veterans, you know, this year than ever before. We've spent more in defense spending this year than ever before. That's great that you want to talk about the spending. But what Americans need to hear is, what was the outcome? What was the successes and what was the metric that we utilized for the previous money spent that gives us any type of clearance to go ahead and spend additional funding? And if you don't have it, I personally think that one of the things that D.C. needs to start looking at is not whether or not we take and spend more American taxpayers' money, but if we don't have the money for unfunded priorities like we do within the DOD or et cetera, the first thing we should be looking at is what can we defund here in D.C. to be able to get that allocation? And I would start with the Department of Energy. I would start with the Department of Justice. I would start with all of these others where we can defund those to go ahead and fulfill the obligations as opposed to just continue to increase the budget, which has led us to the fiscal cliff that we're at today.
Congressman Mills, I mean, there's been some information shared out there online, and I know that you're not a big social media fan, but I'll ask you about it anyway. The TSA that is suggesting that by October we'll be seeing mask mandates again because of this new variant. If a mask mandate would ever to be imposed again, does that come through Congress, or is that something that they can do independently on their own?
Well, it's supposed to come through Congress, and that's the whole point. And that was why, in the beginning, when this whole mask mandate came through with the FAA, they tried to say when their oversight, you know, this is a law, this is that. And when it started getting questioned by actual legislators who were saying, can you tell me where this is a law? Then they just started saying it's an FAA mandate. I can tell you right now that I would not support any legislation that would do anything to remove a person's, you know, medical freedoms. But I also can't see where this isn't exactly into the same play as what they did before. And so you want to wear a mask, you have a right to go ahead and wear a mask. As far as making it mandatory or making it a piece of legislation that's going to be passed and come through the House, I can tell you right now that I would vote against it and I'd be in opposition.
Are there any plans by the leadership of the House to use the upcoming, you mentioned the continuing resolution a few minutes ago, to use those budget negotiations to try to at least rein in some of these extravagances and new requirements and regulations by the Biden administration?
Well, I've made it very clear, Chris, to myself, Byron Donalds, we said this to the chairman of appropriations, Ken Calvert. I said this to the whip, which is Tom Emmer, as well as for others. You know, I voted on the Milcon VA to ensure that there was enough military construction because I'd just gone out to all the chain of islands. That was on the first, second chain of islands where our military installations were. And these are, you know, what they call corrosion five level buildings or environments. And we had buildings that were falling in, and it just wasn't up to the standards that it should be for our service members. And then our VA, obviously, we need to continue to getting the necessary support and the mental health training and treatments, the fentanyl and opioid overdose and addiction treatments, things like that that's necessary. But I made it clear to everyone, as did many of my colleagues, I will not approve and I will not vote upon another appropriation bill until you get all 12 appropriation bill totals out there that we can tally up, where we can see whether or not we are close to that 1.47 number that we talked about in Limit Save Grow. To include, we need to be looking at the nearly $1.2 trillion rescissions, things that we were going to pull back, like the unused COVID funding, like the $81 billion that was supposed to go to the IRS agents and the IRA, looking at certain types of things that we ended up giving up, we not being myself, but the leadership in the Republican Party on the Fiscal Responsibility Act. But until we actually get the total, I'm not going to play the standard D.C. dance where they push all the big ticket items in the very front, things like your Milcon VA, things like your defense spending, and the next thing you know, they try to pass two or three other appropriation bills, and then they start trying to lump things in minibuses because they know that if you try to set it aside in an individual appropriation, that many of them would get voted down or they would get diminished. So they do this little trick where they would put, you know, something for education and something that we wouldn't vote in together.
Right.
And they utilize these minibuses to try and play that D.C. dance. And when you vote against it, they go, oh, look, you voted against education.
Right.
Look, I'm fine with going ahead and standing my principles and standing on my record. I will hold the line. I will make it very clear, and I'm going to start doing a lot of messaging in the district so that people know why I'm going to oppose certain bills, certain appropriations. But the bottom line is that we can't continue to do the same thing over and over and expect a different outcome. And Congress as an institution is broken. And the only way to fix it is start taking hard stances.
All right. We have to take a break. Can you stay with us through the break? We have a few more questions for you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. We're speaking with Congressman Corey Mills for D.C. Declassified as we're getting the lowdown on exactly how things happen there in Washington, D.C. This is why we need to change things. There needs to be a massive political shift in power next year, ladies and gentlemen, and we can make it happen. God is setting the table, but we got to serve up the meal. We'll be right back.
AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer.
Are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? Do you suffer with low energy, difficulty sleeping, digestive issues, frequent illnesses, and more? If you answered yes to any of these questions, Heiss Health Clinic is for you. Hi, this is Renee Humphreys. At Heiss Health Clinic, we use holistic methods to balance your body so it can help heal itself. Call Heiss Health Clinic at 407-677-1660 or go online to drheiss.com so we can help you experience outrageous health.
Folks, did you know Relax and Comfort is the only store in Florida where you can experience both the number one rated number bed and the J.D. Power number one rated mattress in America and compare them side by side? And now for a limited time, Relax and Comfort has a very special offer for American Adversaries listeners only. Get a free X2 model X chair, just like the one I use every day, with a qualifying purchase of any new luxury massage chair or smart sleep system. Call Don, Jackie, or Gio at 407-628-5657 or visit Relax and Comfort at the Winter Park Village, just across from the Regal Cinemas. You can rely on Relax and Comfort for all your back care and sleep needs to sit, sleep, and feel better every day. Relax and Comfort is locally and family owned and operated since 1967. So call today at 407-628-5657 or visit relaxandcomfort.com.
Hi, I'm John Siebert, president of Patriot Home Funding, Central Florida's best mortgage broker, and we are making mortgages great again by offering the lowest rates and best service, all while not charging any lender junk fees or points on most of our products. And if you are a veteran, we will pay for your appraisal as a way of saying thanks for your service. Take the Patriot Home Funding Challenge. We'll give you five-star luxury service and save you money. Give us a call at 407-389-5132. That's 407-389-5132. Or visit us at myphf.com. At Patriot Home Funding, we finance the American dream.
Patriot Home Funding is a licensed mortgage broker business in the state of Florida, NMLS 171699, and is an equal housing lender. John Siebert is a licensed mortgage originator in the state of Florida, NMLS 305711.
Thank God for my life, and for the stars and stripes. May freedom forever fly. Let it ring. Salute the ones who die, the ones that give their lives, so we don't have to sacrifice all the things we love, like our chicken fries.
All right, welcome back to the American Adversaries on a Trumpin' Tuesday, brought to us by Sutherland Nissan. We're speaking with Congressman Corey Mills. As you mentioned earlier, Congressman Mills, here in just a few days, it will be the anniversary, the second anniversary of the pullout, the final day of the pullout from Afghanistan. And then, of course, also prior to that, when the 13 Americans and some, I think, 150 Afghans were killed in that terrorist attack, which could have been prevented. The sniper could have taken the guy out, we now know. Any plans or anything you'd just like to say about that anniversary?
Well, I mean, yeah, we have to acknowledge the fact that we've held multiple hearings. We have submitted articles of impeachment for what was a preventable death of 13 service members, 13 new Gold Star families. But the thing that America needs to be pissed off about is that here we are 2 years later, and not a single person has resigned, been fired, held accountable. And these were all things that was done with political optics over military strategy. And, you know, I've had to sit down and talk with each one of these families of these Gold Star mothers and fathers and husbands and wives and You know, the reality is that we owe them at a minimum to declassify the 23 diplomats who had signed the dissent cables that was warning about this military strategy and showed very quickly that this was going to be a potential issue when it comes to loss of American life. We know that you've got Lloyd Austin on record saying that there was no credible intelligence that would have supported that there was going to be an attack on the 26th of August, whereby I have now gone into the SCIF, reviewed the top secret intel reports that he had access to, that his generals had access to, the ground commander had access to, that very clearly laid out when the planning was going on, where it would occur, when it would occur, and when the planning was finished. More than enough substantial, credible intelligence that they could have acted upon. And so whether it's Secretary Lloyd Austin, whether it is Secretary Blinken, the Department of State, or the supposed commander-in-chief, all three should be held accountable for their actions that led to the death of 13 service members, Americans left behind, as well as for our SIV interpreters who were left to die and who are being methodically hunted down and systematically killed. So we need to start taking real action. And again, this goes back to an earlier discussion, and I know I'm beating a dead horse here, but you know, I'm just sick of leadership and all the Republicans talking about how we've got the majority when we're not truly utilizing it and acting like this. We need to start making sure that we got proper accountability. We have more than enough information. We have passed all the actual formalities. We need to start getting accountability as the American people originate. We need to start holding them accountable when it comes to the fiscally irresponsible spending and making sure that we're allocating that funding where it needs to be and starting to utilize additional funding for departments that are no longer in its initial use to be able to reallocate to meet our requirements for unfunded emergencies. And so we have to start not doing what we've always done, but start going back to what we actually know, which is being responsible for the American people first.
Congressman, back during the 2019 process leading into 2020, we saw articles of impeachment. Remember when Val Demings and all these folks marched in step to bring it in? And it just seemed it was ceremonial. It was ridiculous, but methodical. Why are we now, we're hearing that these articles of impeachment have been filed. Why are we not seeing action on that? Where are the hearings? Why? What's taking so long to get it going? What's the process?
Well, I will say that the one thing that, and again, the Val Demings and the marching down the hall, to Statuary Hall, et cetera, the political theatrics isn't necessary. What is necessary is to actually get things done. You know, I've co-sponsored, whether it was Lauren Boebert's impeachment articles against Joe Biden for the borders, I've co-sponsored Marjorie Taylor Greene's impeachment articles against Merrick Garland for the weaponization of DOJ, for the for Secretary Mayorkas, for the continuation of the open border, for Joe Biden as well, which she had there. I've actually issued my own articles for Secretary Lloyd. There's been a plethora of these, and what happens, you know, is we're not. I will give credit to one thing: we're not the Democrats. We do actually follow due process to ensure that it's actually going to get done. But to be honest with you, at this stage, we have to also recognize that we can't keep treating the Democrats and keeping the left with baby gloves. We have to start playing some of their own games. We have to start being more diligent and going ahead and getting things to happen so that the American people can once again rebuild confidence that the Constitution is being upheld by Congress. So I'm hoping that when we come back in this September session, that we're going to see some real fiscal change. We're going to see some actual appropriation bills that are being nipped. If not, they're going to go to the Massey Act, which is the 99CR rule, which means that it'll continue to diminish from 99% to 98% to 97% until we can actually get it voted on and approved. And we have to start actually getting those impeachment articles filed and starting the process so that we can remove these individuals who are destroying our nation and utilizing our own government to go after and target American people.
I see we're almost out of time, but one more quick question, Chris. Can I?
Make it clear.
So I know your favorite color is orange, and you know when you answer questions, it dwarfs me. So what's your favorite movie?
Oh, God.
Come on.
Favorite movie? Probably Saving Private Ryan. That's
there we go. Of course. I expected that. I have it written down. I figured that's what you would say.
That leaves time, just enough time for me to have one last question. And thanks again for your time tonight, Congressman Mills, especially with everything going on in your life.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. So what are you going to be watching tomorrow night, Trump on Tucker or the debate on Fox?
Well, I'm going to be watching President Trump and, I mean, everyone else, if they want to watch the vice presidential debate. They
All right. Very well put. Thank you so very much, Congressman Mills, and thank you for the great job that you're doing for us. You're just what you said you would be, and that's so very rare in politics.
Awesome work.
And so keep up the great work. We love you.
Thank you, sir.
Chris, thanks so much.
You got it. Congressman Corey Mills, ladies and gentlemen. On Wednesday's show, author and political consultant Ned Ryan joined Mike McMath, Nostradamus, and me to discuss presidential politics and to preview the first 2024 Republican primary debate that was set for that evening in Milwaukee. Got Nostradamus in the Relax and Comfort studio with myself, Christopher Hart. Jeff Sinis is on the bridge, and on the line with us now is author and Trump political consultant Ned Ryan. Ned, how are you doing this evening?
Hey, I'm doing well. Good to be with you guys.
All right. Well, let's talk about the race that's of the utmost importance right now, the ones going on over there in Hungary with the world championships, because
that's right.
See, the Americans did pretty good. Didn't they take the men's and women's 100-yard dash?
They did.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, they took the 100-meter, Noah Lyles in the 100-meter for the men, and Shakari Richardson in the women's. And, I mean, obviously with my dad and his Olympic history and world record, it's kind of
sure.
Something that's a little bit in the blood. So I was fascinated by the men's 1500 today, in which Josh Kerr of Great Britain pulled off a pretty stunning upset against Jakob Ingebrigtsen of Norway, who was the heavy favorite. So been some really, really good races over there, and I've been watching most of them.
Now, there were no men running as women in these races, were there?
As far as I know.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing. And it's good to see the United States. I think this is the first time in like 5 or 6 years the U.S. won the 100-meter dash.
Yeah, no, we've been – well, Fred Curley actually has won it last time. We've actually had pretty good dominance in the men's 100-meter, but the Jamaican women – have been pretty much unbeatable the last, call it, 6 years.
I see.
So they were favored to win, and Shakari Richardson pulled off pretty stunning upset in the 100, and she's also running in the 200. So a lot of good racing taking place in Budapest right now.
Yeah. I noticed that Tucker Carlson was over there in Budapest.
Yeah.
And had a sit-down with the president, Ordon, I guess is his name.
Yep.
He has not been a big proponent of what's going on in the Ukraine. He's not been a big member of the rah-rah, you know, it's about independence
yeah.
team. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think there are a lot of people, myself included, that have had pretty much from the onset very strong questions about what are we doing there. This has nothing to do with our national interest. Spending literally hundreds of billions of dollars, I think, is what the last figure is that I saw. And now I think we've gotten ourselves into a situation in which, listen, the Ukrainian counteroffensive is not going anywhere. Now we've gotten to the point where we might be in a situation where Russia doesn't feel the need to negotiate, which I think is very problematic, because now we've backed ourselves into a corner where they don't have to come to the negotiating table. They don't need this to end anytime soon. And they're probably going to continue on and get what they want, ultimately want out of this, but this is, again, a boneheaded decision by our ruling class to get us involved in this. And, you know, Donald Trump and others have been very outspoken on this from pretty much day one, that we need this to end. We need it to end soon. It's not serving the American people or the American taxpayer well. And quite frankly, I don't see an end in sight anytime soon, which is very problematic.
And now that Prigozhin is dead, either by assassination or accident, Putin is certainly much more entrenched in power and, as you say, less motivated to change anything.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, I think there's a lot of people making decisions in the D.C. world who are still stuck in the evil empire era of Russia, of the Soviet Union.
Right.
And listen, you can have parallel thoughts here. Is Putin a thug? Yes. Is Ukraine our fight? No. Like, you can have parallel thoughts. You can actually walk and chew gum at the same time. I think the thing that's kind of pretty perplexing to me is that somehow they think Putin's trying to recreate the evil empire off a GDP of 1.7 trillion, something like that. I mean, a fairly minuscule GDP. He doesn't have the resources to really build the evil empire. I get that he's trying to increase his sphere of influence, but at the same time, I think the thing that is deeply frustrating to me is that we're not having an honest conversation about how we got into this situation. I mean, we got into this situation because we have been pushing a very forward offensive stance with Ukraine being in NATO, which would essentially, and I'm kind of shorthanding some of this stuff, put missiles on the border of Russia. No one in their right mind, and forget Putin, but nobody in their right mind who thinks I might have an antagonistic force on my borders with missiles is going to sit there and go, yeah, that's, I'm totally fine with that. So it's not even about Putin. It's about a nation that says, hey, you guys have kind of instigated this. At some point, we have to look out for our priorities. And so here we are. Russia's doing what it thinks it has to do. And we're pushing something that I think is completely untenable. We don't want Ukraine, which is the one of the most deeply corrupt nations in Europe, in NATO. And yet there are a lot of people in D.C., Republican and Democrat, who insist on pushing that. And it's not tenable.
Well, Ned, do you think that what Mr. Trump has been saying for months now is actually something that's workable and doable, in that if he were elected, it would be 24 hours when he would get them both to the table and this war would stop?
I'm not sure it'd be 24 hours. I do think that he could probably bring... Again, we're dealing with an age-old conflict. I mean, this is a conflict that's been going on, I don't know, call it a millennia. You're not going to end it overnight. At the same time, I think Donald Trump has that ability to pull people to the table. And, you know, I've had this conversation with him. I mean, I think a lot of people look at him and go, you know, he says some of these things, is he serious? Like, he might actually do some of the things that he's threatening, so we might want to come to the table and have a conversation so that we don't maybe experience what he's threatening. So I think he has that ability because he is a bit of a wild card on the international stage, and people are still unsure what would he actually do to us if we don't actually come to the table.
So kind of like Reagan was.
He'd have that ability to do it. I don't think it'd be 24 hours. I think he'd probably be able to bring it to an end in a fairly short time frame.
Well, I certainly think that it would take a while to negotiate a, shall we say, at least a semi-permanent settlement. But I could see a ceasefire pretty much immediately.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see it relatively soon, but then you have to decide where are the lines,
right?
Where are the lines being drawn?
Yeah,
how's everybody? Nobody's going to walk away happy.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. How do you get somebody to go, okay, I'm not going to be thrilled with this, but I'll walk away knowing that we're going to end? I mean, you are literally losing a generation or two of Ukrainians, and I would argue Russians right now, just being completely churned up as cannon fodder right now.
Right.
And Russia has that ability to keep going down that path. Ukraine, not so much. At some point, You've got to figure out, how do we get to an end, and how does this make everybody walk away going, I'm not terribly thrilled, but I'm okay with it.
I presume that this will come up in the Republican debate tonight, and
the kids' table debate.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a big table,
right? And presumably, I think there's only one or two on the stage that have shown any reservations about Ukraine. But is there another issue that you think that will divide them, or do you think that this is one of the few that would be sort of a stark difference between the candidates?
Oh, I think another stark issue is, what is your plan to battle the system, the administrative state, the deep state, the regime, machine, whatever you want to call it? I think that is the defining issue of 2024, by the way. And Ron DeSantis hasn't figured that one out. I don't think a lot of people on that stage tonight have figured it out.
I wonder if Mike Pence has a plan for that.
Yeah, right.
Let me say this, and I'll say something else. If you are on the stage tonight and do not have a very clear plan on how day one you are going to wage war on the administrative state, devolve it, break it apart, return governance back to the duly elected representatives of the American people, you are unworthy of the nomination. And I could make an argument that most of the people on the stage tonight are unworthy of the nomination on that one issue. Vivek has said some good things. I have questions about him. DeSantis has kind of said some good things, but he doesn't understand how central an issue it is to the GOP voters. I mean, I have to tell you, I think, again, I will say this. I think Ron has been, if not the best, one of the best Republican governors in the country. But he has been... I think he made a very massive miscalculation in this campaign. First of all, he shouldn't have run.
Right.
But when he decided to run, he thought he was running against Trump, that he had to beat Trump and run against Trump to win the nomination. What he actually needed to do was run against the deep state, against the machine, and he needed to lay out a clear agenda for the GOP voters to say, okay, there's an instrument. If they manage to take out Trump, there needs to be an instrument to wage war and to break that state, and I am that instrument. He's not made that argument at all on any level.
No, as a matter of fact, with perhaps the exception of Ramaswamy, none of the other candidates either seem to get that, as I've been putting it, these other candidates are treating this like it's, as I put it, a regular old presidential election. when it's not these indictments and this parade of this whatever it is that's going on in Atlanta today. This is about the fate of our constitutional republic in a sense that we haven't had to deal with in prior elections. This isn't even about Trump. It's about our republic, and Trump is the focus of the efforts to save it. And they just go ahead.
No, no, it really is. No, I think you're completely right. I mean, interject, but nobody seems to get that on the stage, except for maybe one or two. They don't understand that what we are now seeing and is coming into, I think, very sharp focus is two very different governing philosophies that have been competing against each other for the last 110 years. With an administrative state in which unelected bureaucrats are the ones that are really governing. And they really are the ones governing right now in D.C. And a constitutional republic in which all power flows from the people to their duly elected representatives who represent the people to prioritize the people's interests. And these are like oil and water. They will never mix. And it's pretty amazing to me this conflict hasn't broken into the open until now. I mean, there's been tension along the way, but it really hasn't broken out into the open until now because the great outsider, Donald Trump, had the temerity to come in and say, I'm the duly elected president of the United States. I'm the one who decides. And the administrative state said, we don't think so. We're the ones that decide domestic and foreign policy, especially foreign policy. That's the big rub.
Yeah.
And that's the conflict. That's where it all comes down to. Who decides? And if you can't understand that, you don't know what time it is.
All right. So this, what I call it the housewives, the legal version of Housewives of Atlanta. In other words, what's going on in phony Fannie Willis up there is it's a made-for-TV reality, show trial, showcase.
Yeah.
But I also think that that works to Trump's advantage. I mean, he's the king of reality TV. And that this tomorrow, especially when Trump checks himself in up there, is going to be, I think, the high point for their efforts, because these cases are going to drag on. Likely charges will be whittled away and dropped, and it's going to frustrate the left to no end, just like we've been frustrated that the legal system has been slow to go after Biden.
You know, I have a couple thoughts on that. One is they're literally, war of a thousand fronts. At some point, if you start a war of a thousand fronts, one of them is going to work. Yeah. And so they're hoping that somehow something sticks. And my concern on this is that if they make one thing stick, that somehow the Chardonnay sippers in the suburbs are going to go, oh, well, Trump must be guilty of something.
Right.
So that is one of my concerns. But overall, the whole strategy in my mind is the punishment is the process. They are going to punish Trump nonstop, relentlessly, all the way through the fall 2024 elections to try and slow him down, sand in the gears, distraction, weaken. But, the thing that people have to remember is he's not running in a vacuum. It's not as though it's Donald Trump and can he win or lose. He's running against a deeply corrupt grandpa dementia, Joe Biden, who they have to keep going. They have to keep that empty husk shuffling along as long as possible in hopes that this whole house of cards doesn't collapse on them sometime in the summer of 2024. Because then all of a sudden you're left with Kamala Harris. You might even – I have to tell you, I will share one of my theories about what might happen next summer at the Democrat National Convention, that you get to the National Convention and they realize that Joe Biden just isn't going to cut it, and they can't have Kamala Harris. And so I've kind of played around with some of these ideas that maybe there is an approved coup, if you will, on the convention floor in which by acclamation they realize Joe Biden's not going to be the one and they bring in Gavin Newsom. It's a theory. I'm just thinking at some point – I just don't know how long they can keep this charade up.
Well, actually, Roger Stone has a very similar theory, but his theory goes a step further. He says there's no way that they're going to step over a black woman, Harris, with a white man.
Yeah, Michelle Obama.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah, all right. Anyway,
go ahead. I mean, listen, I think it could be either or.
Yeah.
I just have this niggling in the back of my head that I just don't know if Joe Biden's going to be the actual nominee in the fall of 2024, because this is not going in the right direction. When a lot of people are realizing what Merrick Garland did with David Weiss and how deeply corrupt that appointment to the special counsel was, I think people are starting to ask a lot of questions. People who wouldn't normally ask questions, the normies, what's going on here? What is actually happening? And if that's happening now in August of 2023, how does that accelerate through the winter and spring into the summer of 2024? I just think it's not going to. I don't think it's going to get better for Biden. I think it's going to get worse.
Ned, how about this? I am the resident conspiracy theorist here at the American Adversaries, Nostradamus right here. J.D. Rucker is one of my favorite Substack writers, and he has a piece today where he talks about the specter that the 2024 election might get canceled between now and next November. And one of the reasons he puts out is they're not moving on anything. They're not moving to get Biden to step down. They're not moving to put aside Harris. They are moving on, oh, COVID's coming back, and, oh, well, I don't know, it might be worse than before. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's a bridge too far at this moment in our history. Do I think they're done with democracy, representative democracy? I think they were done 100 years ago.
Yeah.
If I'm being completely honest, when you look at progressive statists and their philosophy, they were done with representative democracy a long, long time ago. I think a lot of Democrats, a lot of Republicans in D.C., the ruling class, if you will, find representative democracy very messy. They would prefer not to have elections. And yet, I don't think that the American people would actually go for that. I think the American people would say that's a bridge too far. We will still have elections. So I think they're going to do everything they can to rig and manipulate 100%. I mean, the fact of the matter is free and fair elections do not suit the ruling class.
Yeah.
It upsets the apple cart, upsets the power brokers at the table. They don't like that. They don't want that to happen. So they want to have rigged and manipulated elections moving forward to make sure the right people win. So do I think they will do their best to do that? 100%. Absolutely. Do I think they'll cancel the elections? I just don't. I think you will see absolute outcry, outrage. I don't think the American people would go for that.
That would actually might kick off a real deal civil war.
And that might be just fine with them.
Well, by the way, the New York Times, I think it was just yesterday or the day before, printed an op-ed where the writer was saying that Americans vote too much. we have too many elections, right?
Too much freedom.
They want to save democracy, but we vote too much.
Yeah, less freedom.
All right. Ned, can you stay with me through a break? And we have a few more questions for you. Okay, great. Excellent. Once again, Ned Ryan. Also, don't forget his excellent books, The Adversaries, A Story of Boston and Bunker Hill, and, of course, Restoring Our Republic. Both excellent reads. Both must-have books on your shelf and as gift ideas. You can get them at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so please do. We'll be right back.
AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer.
Hey, Central Florida, Dave Ramsey here. When you need advice on your taxes and want to work with someone who has the heart of a teacher, you need to see Larry Herring, CPA. He's one of our tax-endorsed local providers, and he's ready to talk with you about all your income tax needs. Larry Herring will help you manage your taxes just like any other expense. Take it from me, Larry is your guy. 407-647-7777 or at herringcpa.com.
Network sound and video. Storm season is upon us, and we just never know when destructive weather could damage our property. Hopefully, you were wise enough to videotape your home and commercial business for insurance purposes. If you were submitting a claim to the insurance company, they couldn't watch or play your videotape. They will need a DVD or digital file. Network Sound and Video can create that digital file for you. Call 407-834-8555. 407-834-8555.
It's time to convert and sell more with the best tools made for small, medium, and large businesses to grow online. With JJC Marketing Solutions, you can grow with do-it-yourself, easy website and funnel builder, or they will build it for you. More options at your fingertips with JJC Marketing Solutions. Not only do you get the best state-of-the-art website, but also comprehensive sales funnels, CRM tools, and powerful search engine optimization. No matter where you are, they can help you grow your business with affordable online marketing solutions. Get weekly reports, dashboard access, and full transparency to see how your keywords are growing. Start building your online presence today. JJCMarketingSolutions.com. That's JJCMarketingSolutions.com.
Have you heard the great news, folks? The Supreme Car Detailing Superstores have added a third location to better serve you. The new location is at Candace Drive and 1792 in Maitland. As with their other locations at 510 North State Road 434 and at South Orange Avenue and Sand Lake Road, this new detailing superstore is stocked with all the cleaning products and tools you need for any cleaning task for your cars, trucks, RVs, boats, homes, and businesses. At this new location, you can also test your driving skills on a state-of-the-art simulator. You won't believe how real the experience is. To clean better with less effort, go to the Supreme Car Detailing Superstores. They're open from 10 to 6, 7 days a week. Or you can order online at dasuperstore.com. That's dasuperstore.com.
Stuck in traffic? We've got the answer.
The big problems remain downtown. Closures around South Orange and Church Street. The scaffolding work still ongoing. Westbound I-4, slow around West 1st Street, around Colonial and from Kirkman, out towards US 27. Eastbound I-4, slow around Osceola Parkway, around the 408, around Fairbanks, and up around West 1st Street. Crash 429 northbound before the turnpike, slowdowns both ways around there. Your latest answer traffic. I'm Dave DiRica.
All right, welcome back to the show, ladies and gentlemen. A little tribute there to Ned Ryan and his father. By the way, Ned is the founder of American Majority. You can go to ammajority.com and help him in his efforts to secure the integrity of our elections and save our republic. Ned, I want to get your thoughts on this poll of sorts that was taken at the Sturgis Bike Fest.
Well, not really a poll, but they certainly made their voices heard.
I said of sorts.
Of sorts. Of course, every year in August, a bunch of bikers, hundreds of thousands, get together in Sturgis, South Dakota, and have a huge biker rally. Bikers like drinking beer. They set up a big tent for Budweiser. This big tent could hold about 500 bikers safely underneath all these little overhanging tents. There are two poor little Budweiser employees in this video standing and waiting for people to come and sample their wares, and nobody came. In fact, word is a couple of the bikers actually destroyed several cases of Bud Light because they just don't like the fact that Dylan Mulvaney was on a can of their beer.
Ned, I see stuff like this, and I see these things. Next year, I see a huge power shift in the politics of our country, and I think forebearers of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, hilarious that Bud Light thought a bunch of bikers wanted to drink tranny beer. Nobody's buying that stuff. Nobody's drinking that stuff. Like, at some point, they're going to get the message. I am optimistic. At the same time, I'm fully aware that these corporations, big tech, there's a lot of power. We are up against very powerful forces. At the same time, the American people themselves are a very powerful force. So the question becomes, do the American people have enough information? Are there enough of them with enough information to then create, you know, a cohesive movement that really rejects a lot of what's being pushed by the woke corporations, by the very un-American aggressive left? You know, I'm optimistic because I think the American people still have a very innate sense of goodness and fairness when they have enough information upon which to act. And so that's the question mark for me. Will they have enough information to finally realize these people are doing this? They're trying to destroy us, our way of life, our culture, our society. We're not going to stand by and let that happen.
Excellent. Well, we'll leave it right there. That's AmericanMajority.com, his books, The Adversaries and Restoring Our Republic. And any idea when you'll be on Laura or Jesse next?
I will be on Laura in 36 minutes.
Ooh. Oh, excellent. Well, we'll watch you right here in the studio. Thank you
You'll
so much,
see me
Ned.
Very soon.
All right, we love
All
you,
right.
brother. Take care. All right, we'll be back with more of the American Adversaries Radio Show.
Thursday's show features a review of the Atlanta made-for-TV Trump case with Jeff Bonney, Rick Brown, and myself being joined by appellate attorney Patrick McGarrow.
All right, so that is Jeff Bonney along with Rick Brown and myself, Christopher Hart. We are in the Relax and Comfort studio. Mike McBath will be back next week, and we'll be back to our contest challenge next week. Jeff Sinis is on the bridge, and on the line with us now is our legal expert. He is Patrick McGarrow of the Hall Scott McGarrow Law Firm. That's appealslawgroup.com. Patrick, how are you doing tonight?
Wonderful, guys. Great to be back on Adversaries. I just got back from a 4-day trip to Las Vegas. And just as an interesting aside, I had a very interesting conversation with an Uber driver, a gentleman who just moved from Thailand, and he had nothing but bad things to say about Joe Biden and was cursing the $4.25 per gallon that he is paying as an Uber driver.
Ouch.
Yes, this is a recent immigrant to this country who's already feeling the squeeze.
Yeah, well, it didn't take long, that's for sure. All right, let's talk about this made-for-TV show going on in Atlanta tonight. You've already had a number of the co-defendants turn themselves in, mug shots out there. Donald Trump's going in tonight, presumably going to be a mug shot put out on him. Now, I know it's standard operating procedure, you know, when somebody is arrested or arraigned, but this can't be making the legal profession very comfortable with all of this, can it be?
Absolutely not, especially when, and I keep saying this, like a broken record, but when you're indicting lawyers for exercising their rights to freedom of speech, when you're indicting lawyers for advancing a client's position and calling them part of a criminal conspiracy, this is a very, very, very uncomfortable feeling among the bar.
I would hope that it would be. In the meantime, President Trump changed his lawyer. The new lawyer was announced today. The lead attorney, I should say, for his Atlanta case is going to be Stephen Sadow. And evidently he's had some pretty high-profile cases. Are you familiar with him?
I am, actually. A friend of mine who's listening all the way from Charlotte, North Carolina, who's my former boss, mentor, and close friend. He's retired now, but this is a man, Scott, who's listening as we speak. He's, you know, practiced criminal defense all across the country for about had a great 35-year career. He personally knows Stephen Sadow, and he has vouched for him. He has sent him a lot of business over the years, referred a lot of clients to Mr. Sadow, and this man is a great pick for Trump. It is very, very, very likely that Trump's lawyer is going to be by far, head and shoulders, the best lawyer in the courtroom among many.
Well, let me ask you about that, because already we see that some of the defendants are sort of on their own track. Mark Meadows has been, along with Jeffrey Clark, has been pursuing getting the case transferred to federal court. And I want to get your thoughts on the plausibility of that. And then you also had one of the other defendants who filed to go ahead and have his trial in November. I think John Eastman's lawyers want his trial immediately. And so how is all of this going to work? Because each defendant is entitled to their own defense, but Fannie wants them all tried at the same time.
The short answer is it's not going to work. As I said last time, it's a logistical nightmare. You have 18, 19 defendants, 18, 19 different agendas, times two, at least two, because each person is going to have at least one lawyer, plus the prosecutors, plus the witnesses. Everybody has their own agenda. It's like herding cats when you have a case this big. It becomes extremely unmanageable. Now let's add into the mix a judge who is, I think, 34 years old and has all of 6 months' experience on the bench. Right? This is going to be unmanageable very, very quickly.
Now, on my list of questions to ask you, if you were aware of this judge and his lack of experience, isn't there a senior judge in that district who could say, hey, maybe this isn't quite the right judge for this case?
There may be, but the reality of the situation is, I'm assuming, and I don't know, Fulton County is like everywhere else where judges will get more or less randomly assigned. If you now have a senior judge or an administrative judge stepping in and taking the case away from this judge and either keeping it for themselves or assigning it to someone else, you're going to have an appearance of impropriety. lawyer is going to be crying foul, the prosecution may be crying foul, and no matter what happens, the public is not going to look at this and get a warm, fuzzy feeling that justice is being done.
Well, I can't get I don't think a whole lot of people are getting that feeling as it is now with as it has progressed so far, but I can see your point. But, you know, I guess the next issue is going to be how can they coordinate or force these defendants to all stand trial at the same time if some of them want to go first?
Well, you may not be able to because there's a couple of things in the law that prevent co-defendants from being tried. One of them is if one defendant has made a statement to police or to someone that implicates another defendant, and the prosecution wants to use that statement against that one defendant at trial, but it implicates someone else, the co-defendant who is implicated by the statement has a legal right to have his case severed because you're not allowed to introduce hearsay against one defendant, even if it comes out of another defendant's mouth. That's what we call in the law a Bruton problem, because that's the name Bruton versus United States, a Supreme Court decision that came out. Then there is a principle in the law called antagonistic defenses, where if one co-defendant has a defense that is antagonistic, legally speaking, against another defendant, and essentially makes that one defendant a second prosecutor against the co-defendant, then the co-defendant has the right to say, hey, listen, it's bad enough that I have to face one prosecutor. I shouldn't have to face one of my co-defendants blaming me as well. We have antagonistic defenses, therefore my case should be severed. Then you have all kinds of other issues that could come up with respect to evidence, admissibility of evidence that some defendants want to use and their own defense that other defendants would have an objection to one way or another. There's a lot of different ways to sever these cases.
Can the judge force the case to go to trial even if the defense isn't prepared?
Yes and no. The judge can force a case to go to trial, and this happens all the time where a defense lawyer will come in and say, I'm not prepared. The short answer is, if you are not prepared, you better have a darn good reason why you're not prepared. And it better not be your fault, and it better not be your fault due to laziness or lack of due diligence or neglect. If you can point to that, then you as a defense lawyer give your client a reason to appeal where you say, I was forced to trial on less than complete evidence. And as a matter of fact, in Florida, just 2 weeks ago, a case was reversed for that exact reason. Conviction was reversed for that exact reason. The prosecution failed to turn over critical evidence to the defense, surprised them with it at trial. The defense lawyer stood up and said, whoa, I'm not prepared. I wasn't ready for this. And the judge said, too bad, you're moving forward anyway. The defendant was convicted, and the appellate court said, no, that's not fair. The judge should have stopped everything, reversed, new trial ordered.
Rudy Giuliani, when he came out of the courtroom or the jail yesterday, courthouse, whatever, he basically said, I welcome this case. We're going to win this case. This is about lawyers and freedom of, legal advice and that sort of thing. Would you be as confident?
Yes, because it's state court. Remember, wait, I told you probably a couple shows ago, there's a huge difference between state court and federal court. And pursuing state RICO charges in state court is a much tougher job for the prosecution. It's much more complex. It's much harder to prove. There's a lot of pitfalls. When you multiply that by the number of defendants and the unique nature of these charges, it may become extremely difficult. Rudy Giuliani, who was one of the pioneering prosecutors back in his heyday as a U.S. attorney in New York,
with the RICO.
He was one of those RICO pioneers.
Yeah, that's right.
He knows this stuff inside out. So if anybody's in a position to feel confident, it's him.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, those RICO laws were passed to facilitate his investigations up there into the mob, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. That's correct.
Yeah. This process tonight, obviously, with President Trump is politically charged, to say the least. But this mugshot stuff, what do you think that this is, how this is going to go over in terms of the overall case itself? Is this just a moment, or is this, because, you know, a lot of people are going to be wearing these T-shirts. It's going to become a flag of sorts, a banner to coalesce around. Am I reading that wrong?
No, politically it becomes a rallying cry for the opposition. But as you can see, a lot of the defendants that have already been given mugshots have been smiling for that exact reason. And I remember about 20 years ago, Tom DeLay, the representative from Texas, was one of the first people to do this, went and took a beaming, smiling mugshot. So he didn't look like, you know, like a perpetrator.
Right.
So if Donald Trump has a mugshot taken, he should be grinning ear to ear, because, you know, this is something that cannot be used against him. Now, not for nothing, mugshots can and have found their way into the courtroom as evidence, usually when somebody changes their appearance before they go to trial.
Right.
But they can find their way into evidence, because they may be relevant. If you're smiling as a defendant and you don't have that guilty look on your face, then you take that sting out of that mugshot, and that makes it would take away any evidentiary value from the prosecution. Politically, it takes a lot of that evidentiary value away as well.
Patrick, I wonder if the irony of the fact that these lawyers and Trump are being prosecuted because of a unique legal theory, and they're using a unique legal theory in order to do it. Am I wrong?
Did it doesn't I, sound like it's going to hold up, doesn't it?
You follow what I'm saying?
A uniqueness
here?
Going on there.
You're right.
That's absolutely correct. I remember RICO statutes were meant to take down organized crime, where people were engaging in organized crime as a business for profit. We're talking about a political operation here, or a set of operations, or political maneuvers, right? Not for profit, but for political gain. This is the first time I've ever heard in the history of American jurisprudence a statute intended for this type, for organized crime being used for political purposes.
Well, Patrick, I just have one more question for you, and it has to do with the interview that Tucker Carlson had with Donald Trump that played last night. By the way, it was recorded evidently last week. But anyway, they played it last night, and in it, Carlson asked Trump if he thought Jeffrey Epstein was murdered. Did you see his response? Because, you know, he said, you know, a lot of people do. He says, I'm not sure. He said, there were some screwy things going on. I think he probably did commit suicide.
But a case could be made.
But a case could be made. So what would you tell him?
Yes, a case could be made for anything. But I think we all know for a fact that Hillary Clinton killed Jeffrey Epstein. Come on, let's call it for what it is.
Have to agree.
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, Patrick, thanks so very much. I'm sure we're going to be talking again really soon about this stuff. So you take care. Glad to have you back in town. And hello to you, Scott, out there. Thank you for tuning in tonight as well. So be good. We'll talk
to you
soon. Okay. That is, once again, Patrick McGarrow of the Hall Scott McGarrow Law Firm. That's appealslawgroup.com. This is their specialty, ladies and gentlemen, stuff like this. So we're real honored to have his expertise.
On Patriot Home Funding Friday, Pierce Outlaw and Nostra Dennis and I reacted to President Trump's mugshot.
Nostra Dennis has just sat down.
Oh, I had to get over here in time to talk about that mugshot. Best mugshot ever.
I call it the photo. But anyway, yeah, the mugshot.
You can call it the face of the resistance now.
Yeah, the mugshot madness. I guarantee you that photograph has circled this globe trillions of times probably by now, right?
You know, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words.
Yeah.
Looking at that photo told me more about next year's election than if I'd watched the entire debate among the other chuckleheads the other night, which I didn't.
You know, I thought Kathy had a good characterization. She said it's like a prize fighter. And the guy that was sitting in for Gorka today finally came to that conclusion. He started his show calling it a horror movie poster or something like that. No, what it is the look of someone who is not backing down. And as he puts it, the tag on it, and by the way, he went back on Twitter last night to post this photograph. What a way to go back to Twitter,
why
right?
Not?
I know Elon Musk was probably dancing pirouettes around his bedroom last night. But anyway, he put underneath his photograph, Never Surrender. And by the way, I got my T-shirt. I went on Don Jr.'s site to
get it. Got it already.
Huh? Yes. And they had two versions of the poster, of a poster, and I got one of each. And and they make it very clear, and it's no mistake, that the proceeds, the profits from the sale of these items is going to go to his legal fund. Okay, so there's no bones about that.
That's perfect.
Yep. And they had several different versions of it. The version I got was a black T-shirt with a white version of the Trump image, and it says wanted for president 2024.
You know, it reminded me of that scene in one of the Rocky movies. I forget if it's one or two.
Yeah.
Where his manager, Mickey, his trainer is saying, he's not getting tired. He's getting angry.
That's right.
And the very next shot. Boom, 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 boom,
yes.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yes. Actually, that was pretty much taken from the, was it Scott Wepner? I get his name.
Chuck Wepner.
Chuck Wepner. Sure. The Bayonne Bleeder.
Yeah, when he fought Muhammad Ali. Because I think about the eighth round, he quote-unquote knocked down Ali. Ali said he was standing on his foot as he was moving back, and he tripped. But during the break of that round, Wepner's looking at his guy, goes, I might win. And he's looking over, the trainer's looking over, says, I know, he's ready to go, and he looks mad.